the Colonel. Excuse me. Lloyd Gondoli. Great, you could make it. Great, great, great.
How are you? Oh, you look happy.
I'm fine.
Me boys, Tommy, Pete. Me girls, Cindy, Angie.
Hi.
These are the next stars. Mm-hmm. These are the real people in the world.
I think we ought to do that talk with Jack now. What do you say? Maybe iron this thing out before we start the new year?
Hmm? Let's do it.
Welcome back to the Rewire Movie Podcast as we continue our review of Paul Thomas Anderson's 1997 film, Boogie Nights. When we left the gang, they were celebrating the end of a decade. Film is dead, video is the future. But things start to change in the 80s, right?
Yeah, so we arrive at the New Year's Eve party.
And we get a few important characters are introduced, and also some important things transpire. Amber introduces Dirk to drugs. Now, what I found interesting, and I wanted to talk to you about this, was that so my girlfriend really took a dislike into Amber at this point. This was the moment where she was like, "Nah, I don't like her." And I still like Amber, or I've still got empathy for her. But I was, you know, it's her self-destructive kind of behavior to do this. We see her do it later on with Roller Girl. So she doesn't...
Yep, same thing again.
She loses Dirk through it, and then she does the same thing with Roller Girl. So it's like a pattern. And I think that's just tragic that she's stuck in this roundabout of just doing the same thing over and over again. And what's also interesting is when she takes Dirk away, it's implied, but it's her, Dirk and Jesse are having this conversation, but it feels like there may be a connection there, and that connection then is lost. But then she sees Buck.
Dressed as fucking Rick James.
It's absolutely
he's full Rick James. It's fuck your couch.
It's so good. You know, I was thinking about
the framing of it is amazing as well. Just putting him there, marooned in the middle of the frame with his wig on, staring into the middle distance.
And the other way, he's just like, it's pretty original.
I'm pretty happy with it.
Oh dear. So Amber takes Dirk away. Todd Parker, played by Thomas Jane, is introduced, and he's important to the story and where it's going to go. And I like the way that he's so good in this. But he's you know he's a scumbag straight away because he's already eyeing up Dirk's car. Like I think he says to Reed, like, "Oh, who's there's a sports car in the driveway?" You just immediately know that this guy is an opportunist.
But again, he pulls up like the bad kid in school.
He's playing Fonz. He's the Fonz, essentially, right?
I mean, Fonzie was like 46 years old, which is weird.
he's got a mustache.
He plays it like Ben Affleck in Dazed and Confused.
He does like a
high school bully because they're all kids. They have the emotional maturity of children.
And then the other big thing that happens is that Floyd, what's his second name? Oh, I forgot
Gondoli.
His second name. Gondoli, Gondoli. He was a character from Hard Eight.
Rolls up with his three horribly young, coked up kids who are his new stars.
So Floyd comes in and tells Jack about the future. And this is important, right? Because he is essentially trying to help Jack. He's also another opportunist. But he is trying to explain to him that there's going to be technological advancements. Video is the future. Film is dead. And Jack needs to evolve. Yes. Yeah. And this is Jack's hubris kicking in. He is like, "Nah, no chance. I'm not doing that."
Wait a minute. You come into my house, my party, to tell me about the future. That the future is tape, videotape, and not film. It is amateurs and not professionals. I'm a filmmaker. That's why I will never make a movie on videotape.
I don't know whether it's a meta thing about the film industry.
I think there's definitely something to be said.
Do you think
for
there's
it.
A, you think there's something in that?
Well, if you think about the which filmmakers are out there that are still pushing for film as film, and Paul Thomas Anderson is one of the last men standing, as is Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, indeed.
Not only film, but Anderson shot The Master and Phantom Thread both on 70.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't.
And Spielberg resisted for a long time, and then eventually.
And he wasn't part of that crew, but he's the same age roughly. Chris Nolan as well. I think there's definitely something to be said for like there's a little whether I don't know whether he wanted to foreground. He's never struck me as being particularly belligerent about it. He's never struck me as being one of those film purists. But
Tarantino's very outspoken about it, isn't he?
But like, I mean, I've never heard Paul Thomas Anderson be any kind of purist, but he certainly expresses absolutely zero interest in shooting a film on video. I think he's throwing that in there. I think certainly at that point in 1997, digital film isn't coming in to destroy celluloid. Discussion happened 5, 6, maybe even 10 years later.
It's the downfall of Jack at this point is that he's holding on too tight. I think he says, you know, you're holding on too tight. And the way that they frame Floyd is that they make him seem like he's sinister and bad. He's in shadow with a sort of side profile of his face.
Yeah.
Where Jack is still king of the castle, you know, behind his desk with his posters in the background, and the colonel is still backing him up in the background. So he's still in a position of strength at this point, and it'll all tumble and spiral out of control. But this is his big moment of weakness, is his hubris. And then we have Philip Seymour Hoffman stealing the show as Scotty J, who
is
another tragic character,
moment,
right? And it's his moment. He's seen something in Dirk. He loves Dirk, but everyone's drawn to Dirk. He's like the sun in this film, isn't he? All these characters sort of gravitate towards him. And you can imagine this in his mind as a character. This is the first person he's ever told, listen, Dirk, even though it's dead obvious, I'm gay. And he just goes to kiss him.
He's portraying it, again, very innocent, very young. He's not processing things. This is like, you know, this is his first, it's like a boy fumbling over his first crush, which is probably what this is.
I'm gonna be honest with you, Devlin. Yeah. So I have, not that I went out and kissed a bloke that I loved, but I'll draw back to, and because you're absolutely right, this scene worked for me so well because I see myself in Scotty J. I remember in my early teens, there was a girl in my secondary school. I thought I was in love with her. Absolutely, I wasn't. I was like 14, but I thought I was in love with her. And I remember running from my house to her house, which was fucking miles away, just to give her this necklace that probably cost like £5. And declare my love for her, and I got rejected like Scotty J. And that's what's so wonderful about Anderson's writing, is that I'm not from San Fernando Valley, but I can see myself in these characters and some of the things that they choose to do. And that's what, you know, this is why I was so inspired to want to be a filmmaker, was because I wanted to tell stories like this.
Yeah.
About characters like this. And try and evoke that same response from an audience, from something that I wrote or that something that I made. It's just so wonderful. And it's Philip Seymour Hoffman so great in this.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a meme now, I would imagine. But, you know, his strength as an actor is all in the choices he makes in this
and
wonderful
moment. The way he collapses in his car afterwards.
Ah, it's just, it's so, tears me up. Absolutely tears me up.
I'm a fucking idiot. I'm a fucking idiot. I'm a fucking idiot. I'm a fucking idiot. Fucking idiot.
It's all tumbling down now, isn't it? The house of cards are all starting to fall. Little Bill gets his big tracking shot. So the rule of three comes into play. So we've seen two pretty funny moments. this third one, it's kind of telegraphed, but we know what's going to happen. It's almost like a horror film when you know the kill's going to come and you're just waiting for it. And the way that I said before about the tracking shots that Anderson employs, that they're motivated, like they're motivated by character, or they're motivated for us as the audience to, you know, there's something that it's telling us.
Yeah, and it's handheld as well, so it's like it's got that nervous energy around the edges. It's not that gliding steady cam, and it's not that kind of beautiful slow dolly shot.
And he walks into the door. We don't know what he sees. We imagine it, which again feels like a horror film. Like, oh wow, is this like a gangbang? All these horrible thoughts. And this is where we really just see the kind of sadness of Little Bill, and he just looks so beaten and dejected. And he just walks off to his car, and we follow him. And this is pretty strong. He's got a strong will, Anderson, because at this point in the film, we're what, like maybe like an hour and 20 minutes into the film, something like that.
Yeah, it's 110 minutes.
He's got some serious conviction to be able to say, well, this is how I'm going to cover this.
Oh no, wait, sorry. You're right. It's 90 minutes in. We're an hour and a half. The exact.
Yeah, I mean that's crazy, right? And you would normally be like, well, come on, let's get moving. Okay, we know he's going to kill her, so let's just get her killed. No. This is symbolic.
Yeah.
And the symbolism is that Little Bill's going to go off and kill a porn star. And what happens to the porn industry at this point? It all starts collapsing. The porn star is the thing that is being killed. Amateurs, not professionals. It's so wonderfully done, so wonderfully crafted.
But and he's introduced violence into what was previously this hermetically sealed little bubble.
And what's interesting is, as we go along, and it's a bit like Goodfellas, is that people love Goodfellas, but actually the last 30 minutes of Goodfellas, it's kind of depressing and a little bit oppressive, and the mood is not all this joyous fun. Boogie Nights has got that same thing. And it's what I found interesting is when I spoke to my girlfriend after the film, I said, oh, did you enjoy it? And she said she enjoyed it. But she did say, oh, that second half did feel like it was dragging a bit. And I found that interesting, because that she thought it was dragging.
It's not as fun. It's the shorter section by a decent amount as well. And you know what's kind of nuts is that, because I did just write down some little brief timings of like, in what I thought were important points. The time elapsed between Little Bill shooting his wife and then himself, and the culmination of the most depressing section of the film. Once we get into the limo with Jack and Roller Girl, and Dirk's in the parking lot, that's only 20 minutes long.
Wow, that's a hard crash.
Yeah,
from where we were at in the film, where those characters were in their lives, it's amazing. It's really, really well done. It's for 27 years old, I'm nothing but jealous. I've got to say,
because we get our on screen title now, and it just says the 80s.
We get this documentary, Devlin, it's one of those things where so stylistically, he's hearkening back to his documentary from 10 years previous. Yes, we're also being told a little bit about his character. It's the first time we see some sort of antagonism between him and Jack when he talks about his blocking. So there's a hint of kind of they're not quite working in tangent.
And
there.
The previously adorable but actually, Flanders movies are getting like more violent and more unpleasant.
But this feels a little bit self-indulgent at this point. I actually wonder if they could have cut this down even further, this documentary. But I was interested to know what you thought.
Yeah, I think it's a smart choice to have Amber create an in-movie documentary, because you get not only to hear from the characters which are the subjects of the documentary, but you also hear from Amber. She's editorializing this section of the film for us, so she involves us, so that, you know, the way she indulges Dirk's interviews and the way she cuts and the way she fawns over him in the voiceover narration, I found that, I found that really efficient.
We then get, after the documentary dabbling,
yeah,
for me, Burt Reynolds,
yeah,
best scene of the film. And it's all done with looks and gestures.
Mm.
The Colonel's been caught.
Yeah.
We've hinted at it, but because it was in this, the playful mood of the pool party, we kind of, you don't even give it a pass. You know it's happened, but because the film doesn't really pay too much attention to it, nor do we. But then when the Colonel's in jail, we know why.
Oh, Jack. Oh, God.
You thought she was older. You didn't do anything. Yeah. She was just at the... She was at your place. You were just... You didn't do anything, right?
Right.
Nothing.
You didn't do anything to her.
Not a thing. You know me, Jack. I didn't do a thing. You didn't do anything.
No, I didn't do anything.
All right, nothing.
And this is just some solid acting. It's just
from
it's
both
just
of them.
Really from both of them. Yeah, the bit where the phone cuts out.
Yeah, really.
Burt Reynolds' reaction.
Really great choice on that, because it's
so hard to watch when he's like, "You're still my friend, Jack." And I just loved the way that Burt Reynolds looks at him, and he looks down, and he's like, he knows he's gonna have to abandon. Like, no, you're not my friend anymore.
Yeah.
You've crossed the line. He's almost trying to convince himself as well when he's like, but you didn't touch him.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything. I think that's what he's saying. It's like, you didn't do anything.
Yeah. And then from there, you go to a wedding, which should be super joyful, but it gets very quickly undercut because Jack has discovered his new boy, Johnny Doe.
Yes.
It gets so efficient at this point. That scene, that big Dutch wide angle from like behind, from the side of the table, and you have Jack and you have Johnny and you have Dirk standing over them, and I mean, it's the entire table is bathed in red light with these little like slightly sickly green rim lights on everyone, and you know, Dirk has to sit there and watch himself essentially being replaced.
Well, Jack's surviving.
Yeah.
So he's lost the Colonel. So we know he's lost the Colonel. So he's now recruiting the new talent, which is these amateurs. Dirk's soon to be the past.
Yeah.
And Jack's now accepted the future. Because from there, drugs really takes over this film. The editing in this film is just phenomenal. Yeah. Because the first section, which is all joyful, is done in these long takes, but the cuts are really deliberate and really purposeful. And then in the second part, it's edited just, it's a rush.
Yeah.
No one's thinking. Dirk's not thinking. We're inside his head almost as this thing just explodes.
And we have another sequence of Dirk looking at himself in the mirror. Seems like we.
Yep.
Was it Donald Kaufman says in Adaptation? he's talking about like the mirror motif, but it is, you know.
It's the three parts of the mirror, isn't it? Signifying the three aspects of the character. We're gonna have to do Adaptation because we keep referring to him. It's bad. This is brilliant.
But you know, it is a recurring motif every time Eddie/Dirk he has to compose, he has to look at himself, he reflects upon himself, and this is the last big blow up with Jack, which is, you know, he's got that weird ratty little white headband on. He just looks like so sweaty and pallid, and and you have that kind of horrible sequence of him begging his penis to work.
I love I love watching this again. The supporting characters in the background and their reactions, because it's telling you everything you need to know. You know, Scotty J is almost like covering his eyes. Amber just looks you know, she looks absolutely devastated when Dirk just says, "You're not my mom. You're not my fucking mom." And the way that
Reed has to go chase
this is like a father and son argument that you would have, right? So Jack is the patriarch, Dirk is the son, and at this point he is challenging his authority.
It's like the prodigal son thing.
He
right?
tries his best. He does try his best. He's like, "No, 20 minutes, baby." Yeah. Yeah. And then as soon as he sort of crosses the line, that's it. Jack just kicks off.
If we want to go back to, like, you know, all stories have been told before, this is your prodigal son story. This is your challenging the father for dominance.
Do we pretty much cut straight to Dirk's gonna go into
which I found out from watching the old short film. This was in the short that he made when he was 17.
Oh wow!
Exactly the same thing. Dirk Diggler singing "The Touch."
Dirk Diggler demo.
Keep the vocals up.
You got the touch. Take 7.
You got the touch. You got the power. Yeah. After all is said and done,
The one special thing is highlighted here, isn't it? Dirk has got fucking zero talent in singing. And this is where Mark Wahlberg gets a lot of credit from me, because he is committed to singing terribly and making himself look like a fool. And I just love the feel my heat. Can we get one more of that? Feel my heat.
Yeah.
Hey, did you lay that down? We were rolling at the rehearsal. Yeah. The demise of all these characters. You know, Jack doesn't give a shit. Floyd sat in the background whilst he's just like, you know, do you want me to do anal? Ah, whatever. Roller Girl and Amber are just sniffing drugs.
Yeah, the awful kind of uncomfortable, I'm going to just say, are you my mom? And it's, everyone's, like you say, it becomes fractured, it's, and shattered.
Everyone's unraveling.
The editing becomes frantic, and it's this is probably why, you know, like we were saying, like, it's a short sequence that feels a lot longer than the hour and a half that preceded it. But it's because they're putting you through the ringer.
And Buck and Jesse are now together. He's applying for a loan.
Who's the guy in the bank? It's only the fucking announcer from Wayne's World. And with him, as always, is Garth.
I knew I recognized him.
Party on, Wayne. And party on, Garth. That guy. That's the two things he's been in. Which is, to be fair, it's not a bad resume, is it?
No, he's done well. He's done well.
We only get one shot of Jack throughout this, which is just him walking kind of sadly through a warehouse of VHS tapes.
Yeah, well, he's just like, I think it's Kurt is editing, and he just says, "It is what it is."
It is what it is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever heard of a more kind of diplomatic way of saying it's shit. Everyone's doing the drugs. You know, even Reed's doing the drugs. Scotty J is just in the background.
Yeah, just
it's
in
all
the
unraveling. And Todd's the one who's just the drug dealer.
I love that shot. That repeated shot of him coming home like 3 times with the baggie.
The Amber Roller Girl interaction is probably the most tragic in this sequence of, I mean, I wouldn't even say, it's a montage essentially of, and with the music is this kind of, the tempo of the music, it's not rhythmic, it is rhythmic, but it's scattered, like
it's
you said, it's all,
and
it feels like it's all over the place. It feels like musicians that are just jamming.
I love you, Mom. I want you to be my mom, Amber. Are you my mom? I'll ask you if you're my mom, okay? And you say yes, okay? Are you my mom? Yes, buddy. Yes.
And then we get an abrupt cut. And again, this is like a P.T. Anderson staple, or at least it was in kind of the earlier, certainly the first kind of 3 or 4 films of utilizing on-screen text and on-screen titles in really unusual ways. So far, we've had the title of the film, and then the words "the 80s," and then nothing until a very specific date, which is before we go into the custody hearing with Amber, which has just a great, very simple, very, very stripped back scene of, you know, again, outside, we're outside the bubble, and we see how the rest of the world interacts with these people, and the answer is not well.
No, yeah. It's all judgment. The bank manager judges Buck. Amber is being judged literally by a judge who was a former porn star, which is, yeah, got itself a nice bit of irony. You've got Reagan and Nixon in the background, and these like big, huge posters just lurking over. But this is where Julianne Moore is great. And again, she doesn't have too many scenes of expository dialogue. It's all done through her internalizing, and then this is her moment of externalizing. And just watching her outside the courtroom, leant against the wall after the decision, crying, it's not fun.
Yeah,
is the thing about this, these entire, all these things that are happening to these characters that we love, is that it isn't fun, but god damn, it's dramatic.
It's the flip side of how kind of, yeah, of how warmly empathetic he is towards them in the opening scene, and how much how generous he is to his characters, and how indulgent he is, and how much he allows you to feel for them. And then when they get put through the ringer, that's the flip side of it. You care, and thus it is horrible. Because
And we've seen this, and he's evolved as a filmmaker. He's gotten better at it, where it's now far more ambiguous. You know, there will be blood. He does the same thing. The Master, if you've seen The Master, I think it's fucking brilliant. He does the same thing. It's these character studies, you know, less about story, more about character. That's what he cares about. And you know, the moment that it really does hit home is when the original, so all the music's taken away and it's stripped back, and then Jack's in the limo exploiting Roller Girl. He's trying it, and he looks so uncomfortable. Burt Reynolds plays it so well. He looks like someone who doesn't feel comfortable in front of the camera.
Live, right here on videotape.
You recognize Roller Girl from her films?
Yeah. We watch her films a lot at my frat house. I go to see Sun.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the fucking guy would never believe this.
So, you know, we've done a whole bunch of films together. Roller Girl.
Do you remember me? We went to school together. Your name's Brandy, right? Brandy? Brandy's your name.
No. I know what you're talking about.
Your name's not Brandy?
Yeah, it's he doesn't look comfortable. She doesn't look comfortable. But we're not comfortable because we've got this.
Yeah, which
bells.
Are from it's
Hard almost
Eight.
Like a bell, right?
It's recycled score from Hard Eight. And you know how I was saying that there was a date marked before Amber goes into the courtroom? There's a second date.
Yes.
Again,
it's
straight after. December 11th, 1983. Which
Yes, you're right. You're right.
It's my brother's second birthday. So happy birthday, God. Dan. Here's the most depressing scene in the film.
So Dirk's gone full circle. He's soliciting himself now again for hand jobs, and he's in some car park.
The framing and the lighting in that scene, if I may be permitted to geek out a little bit, just very briefly.
By all means, my man.
There have been a lot of close-ups in profile throughout the film, and also I guess throughout a lot of P.T. Anderson's stuff. He likes arranging people in profile, but I think it makes so much sense when we're in a truck. I've always thought that when you're filming in cars, every time they shoot through the windscreen, it's an unnatural scene, because who the fuck is ever looking through a windscreen?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a mad angle. So it makes so much sense to place the camera out of the thing and through the driver's side window. So you've got that guy sitting closest to us in the camera, and you've got Dirk like huddled in the passenger seat. And it's completely stock still shot from what I remember. Yes. Certainly the majority of it plays out in just
it's all just a still frame.
Shot. And what they've done is they've dropped a key light through the back window of the truck and bounced it off the rear view mirror across Dirk's face. There's like a diagonal slash of light, which is, again, that's like old Hollywood shit. Whenever you wanted to do your glamour close up, usually on an actress, you would have like a letterbox light going across the eyes. But it's also used in, do you ever see Black Narcissus?
Yes, I have seen it.
You know, there's a lot of the same thing in that, right? There's like Jack Cardiff uses those hot lights across the eyes of the actresses, and because, you know, all the nuns are going mad on a mountain. Yeah, so I found that fascinating, and especially that they put a skewed diagonal across his face, and it highlights just how pallid and how kind of sweaty and pale he's become.
Well, they also used it a lot in, do you remember Billy Bob Thornton in, is it The Man Who Knew Too Little? They also used it a lot in that film. You know, again, a film that's
explicitly referencing like 1950s cinema, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's a lot of him in the car and the key lights on his eyes, depending on where he is in the story. And we're not going to give that one away.
They
use that a lot as well. But this is all the downfall. Yeah. Roller girls about to have sex with the boy from the right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
So if you blinked and missed that, that's why she's. You know, again, Heather Graham's great in this. She's just, she doesn't have a lot to do, but with what she does, she really does knock it out of the park. But then when Roller Girl just says no and kicks the guy out, and this is where, again, there's judgment, and this is the thing that really gets Jack up, because he's a creator. He's the patriarch of this pseudo family, but he's also the creative head of this industry that we've seen. And when this kid just says, "Oh, your movies suck now as well."
Yeah,
he just—it's
weird that that's the thing that gets him.
That's the thing that gets him.
Yeah, it's,
because really, again, like we talked about it right at the beginning of the film with his interactions with Eddie Adams when he's trying to proposition him. We really shouldn't like Jack at all because he's just used again to forward his own art.
Yeah. And previously, you know, when they were making films as films and it was fun, you got the impression that everyone was being afforded a certain kind of dignity. And this is just, this has none of that. It's just it's depressing. It's like prostitution, basically. It's like,
yes. Well, this is the moment where it's not that Anderson's judging them, but the way that this is told is that now we are looking at these characters thinking, like, what are you doing? Like, we had no issue with them doing the porn films, but this, don't do this. You know, we're now looking at on them, not negatively, because the world is hitting them. You know, Dirk gets the shit kicked out of him. This guy abuses Roller Girl, abuses Jack. And at this point, we really like them, so we don't perceive them in a negative light. But if this were the start of the film, we wouldn't like these characters at all. And the way that she reacts when she's just like, "Don't you ever fucking disrespect me?"
Yeah,
you know, it's like this is her one moment of outpouring, like all that angst, all that kind of hatred. And, you know, we don't really get a backstory for Roller Girl, but this is as close as we get to it.
We don't know what she went through before she appeared as the sunny roller skating naive. Who is, you know,
nope,
but you don't get the impression,
you get a glimpse,
you don't get the impression that it's happy, and especially the fact that she's Roller Girl and the fact that he knows her real name and that he says it and that he brings all that past back to her. And it's clearly, like when we said, like, you know, they've run away to the circus and they've all run away to the circus for a reason.
You don't ever disrespect me. You think you can fuck? You can't fuck me, you fucker! You can't touch me! You can't touch me, you fucker!
It's brutal. And that kind of...
It's brutal.
And that's when you get the... So I know we've already mentioned this and that you wanted to definitely get into this... this... kind of proto-Magnolia-esque. The stories all converge in one geographical location very quickly, in that the three trucks that have beat Dirk up, they drive off, and the limo passes at the exact same time that Buck pulls into a donut shop just over the road. So we have all these stories of like the lowest point for all of our characters converge at this same geographical location. And then we have Buck, who, as you mentioned, is a guy who has not been seen actually engaging in being a porn performer. He's our confused, muddled, would-be cowboy slash Rick James.
And dressed all in white, though, now.
Yeah, with his now heavily pregnant wife. So, yeah, I'd like to get your takes on the scene first.
So my take is that it's wonderfully constructed.
Yeah.
It's beautifully told, beautifully paced. It's one of those moments of, I'm not going to say serendipity, but it's that whole idea that Buck's desire is he needs money to open up his store. Mm-hmm. Bank says no. We feel bad for him. We know he's got a pregnant wife now. And he's just in this donut shop trying to just get some food for his pregnant wife. Someone comes in, robs it. This feels like you said, this whole random life, how random it is. Now in Magnolia, that feels right to me. That feels
like the central thesis of
the correct choice. It's the central premise of the film. In Boogie Nights, this feels like an audition for Magnolia, but doesn't really feel right for this film.
Right.
And the only way that I could derive meaning is that because Buck's ambitions are so real and everyone else's are so extraordinary, and actually the things that they go through, and this is in direct contrast to what Dirk goes through in the next scene, this feels like it's filmic, feels like the filmmaker influencing the story that's being told. And the story that's being told feels like real characters in real events, and this is the one moment that I think he breaks that. And it's nothing to do with does it work, does it not work, because I think it does work, but I don't think it works in the context of this film. If this scene was in Magnolia, then it'd be fine. I wish that he could have found another device to get Buck the money.
Yeah, you talk about the way everyone kind of pinballs shots at each other and everyone but Buck dies. And that it just feels
like it was it's something that would have been in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. I was also thinking like some of the more kind of deadpan but blackly comic Coen Brothers stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is a case of, you know, we've got a young guy still working, you know, for as monumental an achievement.
Oh, listen, don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing the scene.
But yeah, it's,
I'm just saying that this is the one moment where I felt like the filmmaker's influence.
Yeah.
In the story, when the whole story felt really organic, this is the one moment where I was like, this doesn't feel organic. This doesn't feel natural.
Yeah.
In the context of this film.
Yeah, I get that. I think the choice of like swooping Buck in at this point, what really works about it is that because he is such a, you know, at this point, if you wanted to get a huge negative reaction from an audience and you wanted to absolutely devastate them, you would kill like the, you know, the sweet, naive guy with the heavily pregnant wife who's finally finding some happiness and just can't catch a break. And when I was watching this weekend with my girlfriend, and she hadn't seen it in a long time, she was unbelievably tense at this point because we've had two escalating examples of like, the beating that Dirk takes is vicious. The beating that Jack and Roller Girl lay on that guy is even worse. And now we've dropped, you know, and that, like you say, that bell toll just keeps going.
Yeah.
It's relentless.
You're right. Yeah. Maybe it is just a moment of catharsis, of just like release. Mm. And I think maybe you could be absolutely on the money. I've also seen this film about five times, so it's one of those things where if I'd watched it, it's difficult to put yourself in that position of watching the film for the first time, because you can never get that back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the fact that it gets resolved with a wacky accidental multiple shooting, it does dispatch it. It dispatches that tension quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then it leads us to
probably my favorite scene,
probably the most iconic scene.
Yeah, well, I definitely the most one of the most memorable scenes, because, and we've already talked before, like I've just mentioned it in that previous scene about, you know, is this Anderson almost showing off, but giving us really as a filmmaker, this is what I can do.
Yeah.
And this scene is a cauldron of tension, and
an incredible, incredible set.
It's done in such an innovative way, like the music, the character. Alfred Molina is playing he's on all sorts of stuff, and he's like heroin, coke.
Well, he's based on a. This is based on the.
The Wonderland murders, right?
The Wonderland murders, right? Yeah, yes. So he's playing a real life guy. I can't remember the guy's name.
In this, he's named Rahad.
Rahad Jackson.
Yes, that's it.
I know that there's the what's his name, the Val Kilmer movie about the Wonderland killings. I've not seen it.
It's rubbish.
It looks okay. it looked like because there were a few kind of post Boogie Night films where they were everything that you were worried about Boogie Nights being. I'm thinking also there was the Linda Lovelace movie.
Oh God,
These
you know what, the difference is? You know, we mentioned before about the costumes, is that those films feel like actors in dress up, and this film feels like characters. We don't look at it as, oh, that's Mark Wahlberg. Maybe you do now. I don't know if an audience in 2018 who've never seen this film might go, oh, that's Mark Wahlberg. But no, he's Dirk Diggler in this film.
Yeah.
John C. Reilly is Reed Rothschild. The problem also, with Wonderland, with Val Kilmer, is they are basically playing dress up. And the sensibilities of it is rubbish.
Also, they're trying to go for the true story of what really happened. It's like, nobody gives a shit.
Story as metaphor for life. I want to see films. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's what I'm here for.
I mean, what we've got here is an amazing. Well, he's taken what he wanted and what he needed to take from a true story, and he's mixed things up, and he's thrown autobiography, and he's thrown other bits and pieces in there. And I think you can get to the truth of something far easier if you can access everything available to you. You have to stick slavishly to some story. Like, real life is messy and weird and doesn't conform to narrative arcs, and you have to take into account people's sensibilities and people's recollections of events. And yeah, why not just sidestep it and just kind of approach it from a diagonal, which he does here. So
we get into this scene, though. So it's wonderful, right? We've got the music in the background, which I think when they walk in is Sister Christian, which is absolutely amazing. And then Alvaro Molina is fucking wired.
He's
as
on.
Hell.
He's
he
absolutely
is
on.
So on it. It's great. There's a little Chinese sort of fuckboy throwing around these firecrackers, which is just amazing, because this is all set up. Todd Parker, being the druggy and drug dealer that he is, has got this terrible plan of just selling this rich weird bloke.
He wants to sell him
baking soda.
A key of baking soda. And
Dirk and Reed, this is their lowest ebb, and this is the moment of realization for Dirk Diggler.
That shot of Mark Wahlberg, like when they get inside, and I mean the whole scene
he's acting again. We've talked about it a little bit in this episode, but he's genuinely acting. He's going through his entire range of just, he doesn't understand what's going on. He's trying to compute, And then he gets a moment when you see him
just kind of lock in and he's just staring and that like four or five fleeting expressions cross his face. And you can see John C. Reilly, the like a panicked John C. Reilly, just a sliver of him just filling like the right hand side of the frame. And the sound design just kind of locks in on him. It's
For those that have not seen the film. But love Guardians of the Galaxy. I didn't realize this, but Alvin Molina's character has got an awesome mixtape. But obviously, in the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtracks, which is hugely popular, Star-Lord, that character, has a mixtape. And
they are inadvertently or advertently referencing a violent weirdo drug dealer.
Yeah, but it's fucking great. And then when Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield comes on,
my friend Ricky's
dancing around. Oh, and he's like, he's a buddy of mine. Yeah. Alfred Molina is so, so good. So if you've only ever seen him in Spider-Man 2, what are you doing? Get Boogie Nights on and watch him in this film.
Jesse is a friend. Yeah, I know. He's been a good friend of mine. Lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. He's got himself a girl and I wanna make her mine. And she's watching in Willow's eyes. And she's loving with the vibe, I just know it.
Ricky Springfield, the body of mine. Late at night.
No, I wish that I had Jesse's girl. I'm so jealous.
Fucking great in this.
And then go watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, for fuck's sake.
Yes, and then go watch Raiders. God, what are you doing? And if you want to, by all means, watch Da Vinci Code, but it's terrible. But yeah, it's amazing. It's like this is such a great scene. Well, I don't think he's about to test the bacon soda, so they're going to get found out.
But they've handed them the cash, and they're saying
yes. And that's when he just steps up and says, "Oh, sir, we've got to go. We've got to go." And then
that cut to Tom Jane.
Tom's Jane has this is his moment to shine. Yeah. He is so twitchy, and when he does that laugh, where he's just like,
he can't stop laughing at the firecrackers. And then he starts talking about the goddamn floor safe.
And he's after the money in the safe.
You find out that he's just come in there with the intention to perform what can only be described as a horrifically underplanned home robbery.
Hey, we want something else from you.
What? Todd, what the hell are you doing, man? Let's just go.
In the master bedroom, under the bed, in a floor safe. Understand?
What the fuck is the matter with you, Todd? Let's go.
Todd,
come on, man.
Shut up, Dirk. I told you I got a plan. I got a very good plan.
Are you kidding me, kid?
Nah, I'm not, see? I'm not kidding. I want what's in the safe. We want what is in the goddamn safe, in the goddamn master bedroom, in a fucking floor, on the goddamn fucking floor safe. That's all.
Tom, don't be crazy, okay? Sir, you don't know anything about this, okay? This is not at all what we wanted.
Shut the fuck up, Dirk.
Do not reach for your gun, man. Don't reach for your gun.
On a terribly violent drug guy. I mean, we don't know anything.
He's
about
Joker, is he?
We don't know anything about Rahad Jackson, except what we see of him, which is that he is mad as fuck.
Yeah, he's what is he? He's mad as a bag of chips. He's absolutely nuts. Yeah. And then he runs off into the room when Thomas Jane kills the bodyguard, and then they try and stop him. They're like, no, Todd, no. He goes to the door. Boom, he gets shot. And then during 99 balloons.
996.
Which again, it's these musical choices, right? So P.T. Anderson is picking these like wonderfully joyous 80s pop tracks, juxtapose them with just this horrific violence and overdose of drugs and this crescendo of just madness and tension, undercut by Jesse's Girl and 99 Balloons. I love the way that, well, I don't even love it. I kind of wonder what happened to Reed. Reed runs off into the bushes.
Which just makes me think, for some reason now, it just makes me think of Superbad.
You think that's what happened to him? He just walked through LA for fucking ages until he got himself to a Mexican party where some woman bled on his knee.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. But no, and this is the moment when the prodigal son returns.
Yeah. And it's and that is what it is. He just goes back and he just begs for help. He realizes that he should never have.
His sincerity is the reason why Jack just takes him in without question.
Jack, could you please help me?
Sorry, Jack.
I'm sorry.
Jack just embraces him immediately. He just forgives him straight away, and the pseudo family is.
Mm. And we have the return to the
forming
to
again.
The same music that we started out with, that kind of sad.
Oh no, you forget first, mate. There's another montage where we get to see all the characters. Don't Sorry. Deny them their moments to shine in the sun. We've got the Beach Boys, God Only Knows.
That's
wonderful track.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I love about this soundtrack is that not all the songs, but this one in particular, this is the film that I think of.
Yeah.
I think of Boogie Nights. I don't know why. I guess it is because we're at the end of this film and these characters that are now so beloved in my mind, and we have this wonderful music that kind of lifts.
I mean, when we were
the whole film.
When we were the sort of age that we were when we came to this film, you know, very, very late teens.
I'd probably not even listen to Pet Sounds at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Like this is where you discover this stuff. You know, like how I'd never heard Jumpin' Jack Flash before I watched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Like a lot of this classic.
It's Mean Streets for me on that one, buddy.
Yeah.
But I know for you it's Fear and Loathing. Okay. So God Only Knows, and then we see Buck and his... he's changed identity again. He's gone all Run DMC.
Did I hear someone say deal? This weekend, and this weekend only, Buck's Super Cool Stereo Store is making super cool deals on all name brands. We're open. We're ready. All you need to do is walk over, get down, and come inside us. Word.
But I love the way that Amber's the one that's directing the advert. Scotty J's there.
And the cue cards.
Kurt's there, the cameraman. You know, it's everyone's back. The gang are back, you know. Roller Girls in school. She's going back and studying again. It looks like a community college, you know, night class thing. And she's got that. It's almost like a John Hughes moment.
Yeah.
When she's looking outside the window. And the only the only character that we really see still in the doldrums is the colonel. Yeah. He's just getting the shit kicked out of him in his cell.
Yeah.
But everyone else, not that they get what they want, but they're on the right track.
Yeah.
I love Maurice, who's kind of disappeared from the film. He's opening up his club.
Yes,
but they
Rodriguez
misspell it. Oh, it's great. And then I can't remember who else. Reed is a magician, magician. He is so fucking. I mean, this we haven't given John C. Reilly enough credit, but that's because I think we've got films in the locker for him in particular. But his dexterity when he's like bending and moving is fucking brilliant. Like absolutely. It's comic gold. Like if you've never seen, is it Dewey? Dewey Cox.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone loves him from Step Brothers, but go back and watch Dewey Cox. He's so funny.
Like anything he does when he's Dr. Steve Brule, if you want to see how much this guy commits to the silliest of bits, like
he's such a good comic and actually comic and dramatic actor as well, because in Magnolia we're doing him a disservice to say that he's always just, you know, a funny comedian.
Yeah.
He's so good in Magnolia. So, yeah, John C. Reilly. That we'll leave it there, and I'm sure he'll have...
I kind of feel like that later little blast of him as a magician with a, you know, a topless assistant, and it just, it feels like a template for Joe Bluth from Arrested Development.
Yeah, it does. It does. Like, I want to see that film.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to Reed going forward?
I think we're, and then with you.
And then we come to the circle is complete with the music. And, you know, we see the
Buck's installing the hi-fi. He's got the
everything's joyful now. Mm. You know, they've had a child. Jesse's painting. Everyone, the family is now complete.
It's bittersweet joyful.
There is some bittersweetness in there. You know, you see little Bill's painting.
Yeah, but also we've
a reminder, I guess.
I think now that the we've seen, you know, Jack's not a benevolent presence anymore. I think that sequence in the limo between him and Roller Girl, it's like, it's, you know, it's all just a bit tarnished, but they're all just gonna have to make do because family is family.
They're better together. Yeah. And that's the whole theme of the film, isn't it? In some guys, whether it be ordinary, biological, you need family.
Yeah.
Family doesn't necessarily mean mother, father in the traditional sense. It is that these people come together and they form a unit, and together they can tackle the challenges in their life, you know, because he's quite asexual, Jack. Like, we see him with Amber, but, and they are playing matriarch and patriarch, but actually we never see them, they're together, but we don't see them kiss. No. Or
you see very little physical affection between them. Like,
so it is this strange pseudo family that they've constructed, but that's it. And then we have our Raging Bull tip to the hat.
Yep.
And we finally get to see the big show. Mark Wahlberg doing essentially Raging Bull doing On the Waterfront.
Yeah.
Where he's
I think that was like,
he's just going through his lines.
I think that was what you said, like, last time out when you announced that you were gonna shoot this film, the first line that came into my head was, you know, I'm a star. I'm a big, bright, shining star.
It was the first thing that came out of your mouth. And then we see it. He does deliver on the prosthetic rubber 13-inch cock. And it's absolutely hysterical.
That's how it ends. And I was going to say, I'm intrigued to find out. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask, I may know the answer to this already, based on the previous several hours of discussion, but what do you think? Do you think you wasted your time? Do you think that you would recommend this film to people? Are there any caveats you'd put on that recommendation?
Oh, that's an interesting one with the caveats. No, I definitely didn't waste my time. This really was a seminal film. For the reasons that we discussed at the beginning. So I'm not going to go through that again. Would I recommend this? 100%. If you've never seen Boogie Nights, go out this weekend and watch this film. I think it still holds up. I think there's so much to go at. And what we discussed before about the initial plot of, like, it's about someone, rise and fall story on the backdrop of the 70s porn industry. Doesn't sound like something that most people would want to get into, but just give this film a chance. If you're into filmmaking and you've never seen this, what are you doing? You 100% need to watch this film, because there are technical aspects that are just mind-blowing, especially considering P.T. Anderson's age. And this is, of all his catalogue of work, I would suggest that this is probably his most accessible, certainly for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I would definitely agree on that.
Taken from this podcast and actually had never seen it. One, I don't know how you can listen to us for a couple of hours and have not seen the film. But if you're thinking about maybe watching a P.T. Anderson film, this is probably a good one to start with. So yes, 100% recommend this one. And so much more deeper themes than just someone with a big 13-inch cock. What about you, Devlin?
Yep. Echoed sentiments. I would love to be able to be a contrarian and be a bit of a dick about it and say that it's not all that. But yeah, this film was the same for me. As I said, I kind of came back to Boogie Nights after having seen Magnolia, But when we discuss like Paul Thomas Anderson in the context of the kind of contemporaries that he came up with and the people that were around, I would say that Paul Thomas Anderson has always been the one that I've liked the most. And I think I like him the most because, especially in these early films, like you were saying, as his filmmaking has progressed and as he's become more experimental and he started pushing the form out more, you don't get as visceral a reaction. And again, as you said, this is the most accessible film of his, and it's the most accessible film because it's got that emotional raw nerve to it. It's very generous with its feelings, so it brings you in, and it is. It's technically exceptional for somebody so inexperienced. So yeah. I recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it. I guess probably more usefully, we should tell people that if you've seen it and you haven't seen it in a couple of years, go back and watch it again. Yeah, it's a great watch.
Right then, Dublin, it's come to that time in the episode. What is your next pick for the throwback series? I'm very excited because we are in the month of Halloween, so I'm expecting a horror film, and if you don't deliver, I'll be disappointed.
Well, I mean, I was rolling this one around, much like some kind of superannuated sports coach who sometimes likes to second guess, you know, trying to throw you off the scent. I was thinking about just picking something absolutely ridiculous and completely non-horror themed.
Sound like you.
Exactly. And why would I deny myself the fact that this is clearly my favorite time of year? So no, I'm just going to lean straight into it, and I'm going to choose Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
You know what? I'm excited because I think I've seen it once.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And I was young. It was the moment when slasher films. And just that type of horror film, and Halloween 3 is definitely not that. But yeah, the Halloween series, the Friday the 13th series, the Nightmare on Elm Street series, I was big into them during my sort of mid-teens. Yep. So yes, I've seen Halloween 3, but I remember being bitterly, bitterly disappointed.
Now
so,
this is fun.
This I'll be interested be, as, be a as a 32-year-old man, can something change over time? I'm sure it can. So I'm looking forward to going back and revisiting it, because I genuinely can't remember much other than the theme track or the song at the end.
Yeah.
I'm on the right tracks, aren't I?
You are. I'm very much looking forward to that. It's gonna be a fun one. Probably, I don't want to preempt anything. Obviously, I might assume it's going to be a little bit less intellectually masturbatory than this week.
So thank you very much for listening. We very much appreciate it, and I will see you next time on the Rewind Movie Podcast. It's Gally signing out.
Should I leave you with a poem?
Please do, Devlin.
Okay. I love you, you love me, going down to the sugar tree. We'll go down to the sugar tree and see lots of bees playing, playing. But the bees won't sting because you love me. That's it.
Fantastic. Thanks for listening, guys.
I committed that to memory, by the way.
You did. Well done. Rhyming couplets as well. Fantastic. Hi, everyone. I've got a quick favor to ask. If you enjoyed the podcast, could you rate and review the episode on whatever platform you're listening to it on? For more information about the podcast, check out rewindmoviecast.com. Also, find us on Twitter and Instagram and let us know your thoughts about each episode. Once again, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Rewind Movie Podcast. Don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.